It's 19 hours 30 UTC on Tuesday, January 9th, and this is Zimbabwe Today.
And make their statements testimony free of any fear, harassment, or intimidation.
That was Ambassador Johnny Carson with the U.S. Institute of Peace talking about Zimbabwe's recently signed National Peace and Reconciliation Act. We'll have more on that story coming up. Good evening, I'm Chidonjere, and I'm Kadzinai Mutetwa on VOA's Zimbabwe Today. There are reports that Zimbabwe's government plans to shut down some of its money-losing state-owned enterprises in a bid to reduce pressure on the budget. Reporter Kudzai Zinawashe has more on the idea from Harare.
David Chafika is a member of the ruling ZANU-PF and a member of parliament representing Mutoko South. He says state-owned companies, also known as parastatals, are not supposed to make money.
The critical issue is not to make profit. It is to provide services, efficient services.
Chafika, who is the parliamentary portfolio chairman on finance and economic development, notes that due to poor management and other factors, most Zimbabwe parastatals are inefficient and unsustainable. As a result, they constantly need government bailouts and may not be able to provide the needed services.
Those parastatals who are not doing that, they should be disposed. If it is a question of management, if they are critical, but it's the management must be replaced.
Professor Ashok Chakravarti is an economist and consultant in the office of the president under the Ease of Doing Business project.
There are 114 parastatals, and altogether they have capital assets worth about $15 billion. Now, most of them are loss-making, and so that's a loss to the nation. In fact, in 2017, the total subventions that the parastatals required from the budget was between $270 and $300 million.
The government already has said it has plans to sell stakes in at least 8 companies. Chakravarti says more may be opened up for privatization. The government says, however, it will retain control of critical services such as the utility companies. Zimbabwe's Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa, in his 2018 budget presentation, said the government will close state companies beyond redemption. However, Chakravarti and Chafika both think it is very unlikely many parastatals will close entirely. Eddie Cross is a member of parliament for the opposition MDC. He would welcome closing some of the companies.
I think it's totally realistic. The number of jobs involved are very small. When you get a parastatal which hasn't submitted accounts for 5 years to the Auditor General, for heaven's sake, what are they doing? Why are we spending money on it? And they appear in the budget every year. So I think that's overdue.
Advocates of privatizing or closing parastatals say it will open the door to fresh investment and create more jobs. Barely 2 weeks since the government called for bids for stakes in parastatals, offers have begun arriving, within and beyond Zimbabwe's borders. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Late last week, Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa signed the National Peace and Reconciliation Commission Act, 2 years after the commission was created. The signing of the act is being seen as a positive step to promote national healing, unity, and cohesion in Zimbabwe. The commission is to be active for 8 more years. There is concern that the 2018 budget sharply cuts funds for so-called Chapter 12 commissions, such as the Peace and Reconciliation Group. Some opposition critics also say the commission should be led by a non-Zimbabwean, perhaps someone from the African Union or Southern African Development Community. I spoke with Ambassador Johnny Carson, senior advisor at the United States Institute of Peace and the former U.S. ambassador to Kenya and Zimbabwe, about the implications of the Peace and Reconciliation Act.
It needs to have not only the cooperation of the government, it needs the full funding of the government. The finance ministry and appropriate ministries need to make available the necessary resources that are essential for the commission to run effectively. Thirdly, it needs the confidence of the community so that they know that they can go in and make their statements and testimony free of any fear, harassment, or intimidation. The commission also needs to have leaders of great respect and integrity in the community. The commission needs to be able to have public sessions that are open to the community as well. All of these things will help to contribute to a good commission. Civil society, church groups, media, activists need to be, and citizens especially, need to be confident that this is a serious endeavor.
Do you think that once the information has been received that there should be criminal proceedings?
I think that in some instances, reconciliation, true reconciliation, cannot move forward unless there is justice as well. In other situations, I think that reconciliation should go forward without the threat of punishment, lest that unleash new rounds of harassment, intimidation, and violence.
Do you think that there will be a formal commission that looks into the 1980s Kukurahundi massacres?
I think this is a first positive step forward. I am pleased that the president has signed the legislation. I think there should be some of reconciliation and peace discussions after the Gukurahundi massacres of the 1980s. Some 20,000 people were killed during that period in the early 1980s. Many of the families of the victims have remained silent and unreconciled. I think there is a need for peace and reconciliation activities to occur. I think it will help to strengthen the nation, not weaken it. I will help to bring it together and not to divide it. I think that it will help to bring closure and not to fester lingering resentment. So I think the peace and reconciliation legislation is a good first step forward.
That was Ambassador Johnny Carson, senior advisor at the United States Institute of Peace and the former U.S. ambassador to Kenya and Zimbabwe. In a statement yesterday, MDCT leader Morgan Tsvangirai made that many Zimbabweans thought hinted at retirement and the future of his political career. Today, MDCT spokesman Obed Gutu says Tsvangirai is not stepping down and will be the party's candidate in this year's election. Some social media users were initially supportive of his retirement, but others saw it all as a cynical political game. Hamurambe says could be mind games to confuse ZANU-PF.
Munyara Dzimupondi says, retiring because of sickness and talking of handing power to the younger generation. Hypocrites. If he wasn't sick, would he really leave? He shouldn't retire for others as well.
Bigichi Toro says, the way MDC ran out of steam when Robert Mugabe was removed is the same way ZANU-PF may have to redirect if Tsvangirai retires.
Mike Mudzaki says, had it not been for his health status, he wouldn't have thought of handing over to Chamisa, an unconstitutionally elected deputy. Nepotism and tribalism at its best. Kupe is supposed to take over.
Brian Simbada says, "I respect him, a man who speaks with wisdom and realizes the impact of his words, unlike that other guy."
Masimba says, "So he's being sidestepped. He is like a villager now. Can someone who knows what's going on tell us?" Kenyan officials oppose a recent decision by Zimbabwean authorities to export live elephants to China. They say the move could lead to increased poaching in Africa. Reports of the sales to Beijing have irked wildlife activists. Ruben Chama reports from Nairobi.
Speaking to reporters in the Kenyan capital, the officials and other conservationists said Zimbabwe's move, though legal, could pose a major threat to the iconic species. Under the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, or CITES, trading of live elephants is legal, but it is increasingly being debated. Patrick Omondi is an elephant expert and Kenya's Director of Treaties at the Ministry of Environment.
Yes, Zimbabwe exports baby elephants to China, not to trade. In ivory. Ivory, as I said, there's international ban. But if they want to sell, then they petition CITES, a special request, because their population is already in Appendix 2. It's not an open check. You have to bring it to 183 countries and justify that if you trade, it will not lead to an increase in trafficking and poaching.
Omondi says the discussion came up recently during a CITES meeting in Geneva, where representatives from the African Elephant Coalition, 29 African nations that represent 70% of the elephant's range, raised serious concerns on the trade.
We tried even in Geneva in last November just to get a stop to define where you take them and why. Because elephants are like human beings, they live in family. And if you remove baby elephants, it's just being unfair. Elephants live just the way we live, and that discussion is ongoing. So we do not support it as a country. And we have petitioned CITES, not once, not twice, to try and bring this to a stop. And we'll still continue campaigning for that.
Jim Nyamu, the Executive Director of Elephant Neighbors Center, who is leading a new campaign to protect elephants and rhinos, says he is concerned.
There are four countries in Africa, South Africa, Namibia, Botswana, Zimbabwe. Their population, according to the CITES, is in Appendix 2. And Appendix 2 means they can trade on elephants. They can trade on ivory, and they can trade even on live elephants. And that's where you've seen the issue between Zimbabwe selling the animals, and we are happy at least with this new government, perhaps things might change. So you see the poaching upsurge is coming to Africa, is coming to East Africa. And remember, Zimbabwe, they're actually sitting on the corridor, because the animal from Kenya, they go the way to Seru, Marawi, all the way to Zambia, all the way to Okavango, you know, so they're sitting on the corridor.
Traditionally, Kenya has been in the forefront of wildlife conservation in Africa. Omondi says the effort has succeeded.
Our last estimate was 32,000 elephants by the end of 2017. 32,000 elephants, up from 16,000 in 1989. It's more than doubled. So trade has an impact, reduced to 16,000 by the time the ban was in force. So the ban has worked, and that's why we always say, let's sustain this ban for the sake of the future generation and for the sake of the elephants. Let's sustain the international ban in ivory trade.
The latest figures show that since 2013, elephant deaths from poaching in Kenya are down 80%, while deaths of rhinos have fallen 90%. China has recently banned ivory trading, a move that activists hope will be a turning point for the survival prospects of wild elephants in Africa. Pressure is also mounting for other markets such as Britain and Japan to follow suit. Ruben Chama for VOA News, Nairobi.
The World Health Organization warns heavy rains and flooding in the Democratic Republic of Congo may exacerbate the country's ongoing cholera epidemic. Lisha Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Heavy rains in the DRC last week triggered flooding and landslides in the capital Kinshasa, causing 45 deaths and widespread damage. The World Health Organization warns the flooding also is likely to worsen the cholera epidemic and other waterborne diseases. The current outbreak, which began in July, is one of the most severe in years. The WHO reports people in 24 out of 26 provinces have been infected with the disease. Latest reports find 55,000 cases, including nearly 1,200 deaths. WHO spokesman Christian Lindemeyer says this is almost twice the number of cases reported in 2016.
The case fatality rate in general is at just slightly over 2%, but in some provinces it is much higher. In four provinces, the case fatality rate is more than 5% and actually much larger sometimes.
He says in Kinshasa, the case fatality rate is 13%. In Kasai, 14.5%, and in Tanganyika, just over 11%. The DRC rarely gets relief from humanitarian crises. Lindemeyer tells VOA that perpetual conflicts complicate efforts to respond adequately to the cholera epidemic.
Given the circumstances, with a conflict, with lack of access, with displaced people, including now flooding, this is not unusual, unfortunately. This is a situation which facilitates the spread of cholera and other waterborne diseases very badly. And the conflict, of course, makes any sort of attempt to treat or to help the people worse.
The Central African country has 4.5 million internally displaced people, the largest IDP population in Africa. The WHO warns poor access to safe water and sanitation and poor hygiene practices are the main factors driving the latest cholera outbreak. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Around 200 people were injured today when two passenger trains collided in a suburb of South Africa's main city, Johannesburg. The emergency service network, ER24, said authorities are investigating the cause of the accident and have released few details. News reports says one train was sitting on the track and the second hit it from behind. No fatalities were reported. The accident took place days after at least 18 people were killed and hundreds injured in a train accident in central South Africa. In that incident, the locomotive hit a truck, derailed, and burst into flames.
Voter registration is underway in Cameroon ahead of nationwide elections later this year. However, the electoral body is encountering both voter apathy and challenges due to insecurity in some parts of the country. Moki Edwin Kinseka reports for VOA from Yaoundé.
The staff of Cameroon Elections Management Body, ELECAM, move from shop to shop at the Bizim Fundi Market in Yaoundé, convincing potential voters to have their names registered on electoral lists. 34-year-old business lady Winifred Bway decides not to sign up.
Last election year, I went to vote. I saw that somebody have already voted. I saw my name that somebody have already voted, and I was not the one. And political parties are complaining that the elections are always rigged by the ruling government. So I don't think my voting will change anything.
Cameroon plans to hold local council, parliamentary, and presidential elections starting in September. If held separately, the polls could continue into October. Few see much suspense as President Paul Biya seeks re-election. He is one of Africa's longest ruling heads of state. The ruling party has controlled parliament and most local councils for decades. ELECAM officials who are appointed by the president have dismissed allegations of rigging as unfounded. Besides the voter apathy, election workers are struggling with insecurity in several parts of the country. Cameroon is currently experiencing tensions in its two English-speaking regions where separatists have declared independence for a new state they call Ambazonia. The year-long crisis has led to bouts of violent unrest. Voter registration has been suspended in some places like Manyu Division in southwestern Cameroon, where there have been regular clashes between the military and armed separatists. Meanwhile, the Central African State also continues to battle Boko Haram in its far north region. The suicide bombings that re-intensified in mid-2017 have abated, but many people are yet to return home. As of November 30, the UN Refugee Agency reports a total of 240,000 internally displaced people in Cameroon, nearly all of them in the far north. Pauline Jowe, official of the opposition political party, the Movement for the Defense of the Republic, says the Boko Haram conflict has left people unable to register to vote.
Ce précieux sésame aujourd'hui se fait très rare. Surtout que certaines postes d'identification dans nos zones, l'influence...
He says many potential voters are unable to acquire national identity cards because police identification stations in some border zones were closed due to Boko Haram terrorism. He says if the elections management body ELECAM and the government want many more people of voting age to register, they should reopen the identification offices. ELECAM says it can only move into conflict zones in the north and some villages and towns in the Anglophone regions to begin voter registration once the military declares those areas safe. The electoral body aims to register 10 million from the estimated 12 million people in the country aged 20 and above and eligible to vote. So far, 6.5 million voters have registered. Abdoulaye Babale, head of ELECAM, says they will intensify their efforts.
We are developing a new strategy. In rural areas, generally people take their time. We are going to have caravans, informing them long in advance, and then we implicate the traditional rulers and civil society to help us, because time is against us. In medium cities, we also have our caravans and multiply our enrolling stations in order to catch as many voters as possible.
No date or dates for the polls have been set. Voter registration is scheduled to end the day President Paul Biya makes that announcement. The president can postpone the elections if calm does not return to hot spots. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
In Cape Town, South Africa, and other cities along coastal lines, shark attacks can discourage tourism and cut into pleasure of enjoying the alluring waters. Today, that fear has been minimized in South Africa by official shark spotters on the False Bay coast in South Africa's Western Cape. They position themselves on a nearby mountain and keep their eyes on the water. They've successfully prevented several potential attacks on swimmers since the formation of the Shark Spotters organization 14 years ago. Reporter Nadia Sami caught up with Monwabisi Sikoyaya, said to be the country's very first spotter. He explains to her how his unusual job came about.
Monwabisi, you were the original shark spotter in South Africa. That's a pretty unique job. How did it come about?
Coming from the life saving background, and I've been doing life saving since I was a young kid. 2004, in Muizenberg, there was a shark incident when a young boy lost his leg. Obviously, it was the first incident in many years, and like you have staff schools and local like businesses on the beachfront. And obviously, like, everybody was so terrified of sharks and knew very little about sharks. And so people were scared to go back into the water. The surfing community had to actually come together and find ways of actually getting people back into the water. So that's how the program came about.
So when a shark spotter is positioned somewhere, like on Boys Drive, for example, with their eyes peeled on the water, what are they actually looking for?
There's a lot of things to see up there. You have dolphins, you have whales, you have seals, you know, so obviously just look at like the swimming patterns, and they have different swimming patterns and stuff. So basically it's like the big duck shape. Some call it like a duck shadow.
How effective has the role of shark spotters been since its inception?
Given the fact that it is environmentally friendly. I mean, if you look at other systems elsewhere in the world, you have gill nets, you have drum lines. All of that is actually designed to catch and kill. At the moment, we're sitting at one shark incident in 3 years. So that's how effective shark spotting program is. If you look at 2004, there was 2 incidents in False Bay. Then you're looking at 2005, there was 1. Then 2006, there was 1. So between 2006 and 2010, there was no incident up until 2010 in January. Then the following year was another incident. Unfortunately, that one shouldn't have happened. It was one of those things when people like ignore our calls, and unfortunately, this guy just decided to go into the water, knowing that there's a shark in the water or in the area, and he decided to go out and he lost his leg. You know, that shouldn't have happened.
An unnecessary incident.
It's actually very upsetting. The shark incidents, they're very traumatic incidents, and the local community gets like so much affected by it. It's not only the person that gets taken or bitten or the family of that person, but everyone gets affected by it. I mean, local businessmen lose money. People, they're just so scared of sharks. They're just scared of going to the water.
As the original shark spotter in the country, you would have probably made the first shark spotting. Tell us about that day, where you were, how it unfolded.
Well, I started off here on the beach, and I was just posing as a lifeguard. And I was just waiting for something to happen. And as we all know, prevention is better than cure. Someone came up with an idea of actually having to be on an elevated spot and actually look down. And that's where I was equipped with polarized glasses, binoculars. And on day one, I had like my first 3 sharks. My first 3 sharks, yes. Wow. And I mean, it's like I will never forget that day. And actually, over time, it actually started like changing my perception. And actually, I started like have like so much respect for sharks. It's a matter of having to understand them and having to learn more about them. Back at the time, if there was a shark scare, as you see, like this parking with like parking area with like thousands of cars and numbers of people in the water, it's like if there was a shark scare at the time, people leave. Like 15 minutes, this place is a ghost town. Mm-hmm. So what's happening now, people will just wait on the edge of the water for an all clear. So there's
a much greater sense of calm about the whole situation.
It's all about information, understanding, and that's what it is. And like we are now sharing the ocean with sharks. We are like we coexisting with them. I mean, it's like if one is seen now, people get out of the water and the sharks like just, we call them drive-bys, you know, they just swim past. Once they left the area, people go back into the water. That's how simple it is.
That is it for us this evening on VOA Zimbabwe Today. I'm Chido Ndrede.
And I'm Kudzunai Mutetwa. We'll be back again tomorrow at 9:30 p.m. Zimbabwe time for the latest news and analysis in English. VOA Shona and Ndebele broadcast can be heard at 7 a.m., 2 p.m., and 7 p.m. Zimbabwe time.
Stay with us around the clock on Facebook at Studio 7, VOA Ndebele and VOA Shona, as well as our VOA website, www.studio7news.com. We leave you with a song by Toki Vibes.
I'm going to go to the house.